Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who assesses growing violence and repression in Afghanistan. Tyson Slocum with Public Citizens Energy Program, who discusses yet another wave of soaring U.S. gas prices and calls for an oil company windfall profits tax. And historian John Kayonis-Fadden, who examines the historical roots of a current land dispute that has triggered conflict in the Iroquois Confederacy in Ontario, Canada. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley, who complained about her supervisor's inability to connect the dots before 9/11, is on another lonely road. She's seeking to oust Republican Congressman John Klein in the conservative-leaning 2nd Congressional District in Minnesota. True to form, Rowley is running an unconventional campaign. She's dismissing advice from political consultants to style her hair and to use her 2002 Time Person of the Year cover image with two other women whistleblowers in campaign literature. Instead, the whistleblower is relying on her guts and strong opposition to the war in Iraq. At first, Rowley resisted appeals for her to run for Congress, but she agreed to get into politics after President Bush passed over her nomination to the Privacy and Civil Rights Oversight Board. As Rowley told Mother Jones magazine, right from the start, you hear money, money, money. The whistleblower shocked the local political establishment last August when she went to Cindy Sheehan's anti-war encampment outside of President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. On the stump, Rowley says Iraq is a hot-button issue in the Republican-leaning rural district, and she says she is the best messenger, a former career FBI agent and a lifelong Republican until the Bush administration manipulated intelligence to justify the invasion of Iraq. Islamic Iran, a Muslim nation with an intolerant image, has crafted one of the world's most progressive AIDS prevention programs. The HIV/AIDS program walks a delicate tightrope between explicit talk about sex and respect for the teachings of the ruling Shiite authority. An Iranian can be flogged for drinking alcohol, but the government gives out clean syringes and methadone to heroin addicts. Moreover, government-run health clinics offer free HIV testing, counseling, and treatment. The Islamic government estimates there are 12,000 people in a Middle East country with AIDS, but HIV health workers say the number is five times higher. Tehran's coordinator for the United Nations AIDS program says they are passing out condoms and syringes in prison. This is unbelievable. In the whole world, there aren't six or seven countries doing that. AIDS advocates feared what would happen after the election of ultra-conservative President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His health minister dismissed AIDS as a priority, and the education minister stopped printing AIDS pamphlets aimed at youth. But suddenly, the Iranian president publicly supported passing out methadone to addicts, and the innovative AIDS program came back to life. In a new alliance for clean energy, farmers who grow corn, soy, wheat, and even some dairy farmers are pushing Congress to look for new power sources directly from America's agricultural lands. The new campaign, 25 by 25, which has the backing of mainstream farming groups, seeks to have a quarter of all U.S. energy come from ethanol, processed animal waste, and wind and solar power generated from farmlands. At the moment, these sources only provide 4% of the American energy mix. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, the initiative aims to merge the strong support for production of biofuels in the heartland and the support for renewable energy. Already, the campaign has won the backing of prominent conservatives like former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, the former budget chief for President George W. Bush. Yet, some environmentalists remain skeptical. Greens worry that large-scale production of biofuels could lead to more monoculture crops like switchgrass that could threaten wildlife habitat and biodiversity. Others worry about the levels of pesticides, fertilizers, and fuel required to harvest the new energy-rich crops. As Nathaniel Green of the Natural Resources Defense Council observed, If these plans aren't drafted with sustainable guidelines, clearly that could be a problem. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
While much of the world focuses on the continuing bloodshed and chaos in Iraq, the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan receives comparatively little attention. However, a rocket attack targeting the U.S. Embassy in the Afghan capital of Kabul on April 19th is a reminder of the increasing number of recent attacks and suicide bombings by Taliban fighters across southern and eastern regions of Afghanistan. While the rocket attack missed the embassy and no one was injured, some Afghan civilians were not so lucky in a series of incidents in mid-April. 7 civilians were killed and 3 were injured in a U.S. airstrike in Kunar province on April 15th. 4 of the dead were children. In Khost, American soldiers shot and wounded 3 women and a newborn girl returning from a hospital on April 17th. A man and a 7-year-old boy were also shot and injured April 18th on the outskirts of Khost by U.S. troops. According to U.S. military officials, both incidents occurred when vehicles failed to slow down at checkpoints. Human rights groups are also decrying a deteriorating situation for women inside Afghanistan. The United Nations reports that during 2005, 300 girls' schools were burned down, while women's literacy is half that of men. 1 year ago, the Bush administration succeeded in eliminating the post of the UN's top human rights monitor in Afghanistan after he had criticized the U.S. military for arbitrary arrests, illegal detentions, and abuses committed by American-led forces. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who assesses the growing violence and repression in Afghanistan.
The deaths that you've been hearing about recently highlight the disregard for the lives of the people that the U.S. military is supposed to be there helping. The fact that it's escalating is due to the fact that the U.S. has escalated the number of strikes that it's doing. I don't think it's changing in terms of the likelihood of killing civilians or not. But obviously, the U.S. is not as concerned about the civilian population as making a dent of some sort in the anti-U.S. forces there, which also are escalating their own attacks. The groups that are fighting the U.S. are getting a lot of support right now from the bordering provinces of Pakistan, which is right on the border with Afghanistan. So most of the activity that we're hearing about is taking place right on the border provinces, with U.S. forces attacking so-called militants in the bordering regions of Afghanistan, while in Pakistan, the forces that are attacking U.S. troops are getting replenished supplies and getting new militants that are coming in from Iraq. And the whole Al-Qaeda operation is in full swing once again. The recent killings of civilians by U.S. troops show that the anti-U.S. militants are very well blended into the population. And it may even imply that there's some degree of support by the population for these forces.
What's the relative stability of the government of Hamid Karzai, a U.S. ally who's installed as president, elected as president, and the role of the warlords there?
Mm-hmm. It's a very strange situation because Karzai is probably the least hated of all the government forces and anti-government forces and foreign troops in Afghanistan. I mean, he is kind of grudgingly supported by most of the people, I believe. They're slowly becoming more and more jaded with him. For example, when he ran for president, after he'd been essentially appointed president by the UN and the U.S., and then he actually ran for president in elections, 70% of the population voted for him. So he was very highly supported, but that was because they thought he was implying that he was going to reduce the power of the warlords. And when he didn't do that, people are becoming more and more jaded. I mean, now a year after the presidential elections in autumn 2005, they had parliamentary elections. And in some places, like in Kabul province, which is where the capital is, where the most you would think that the most kind of liberal people would live. Only 30% of the population voted for parliament because they had realized that they can't really change anything by elections. Some of them were upset because a lot of the people running for parliament were warlords. And in fact, after the elections, about 50% of the parliament is known to be either warlords or extremist fundamentalists. The parliament is made up of a lot of people who are known war criminals. The stability of this kind of situation, it's too soon to tell how this is going to play out, because Karzai is playing a very interesting game, trying to act in what's perceived as the interest of some warlords and fundamentalists, but at the same time acting and doing other things in the interests of some more liberal people.
Well, James Ingalls, as you and our listeners, I know, read, Abdul Rahman was arrested for apostasy for his years earlier conversion from Islam to Christianity. He faced the death penalty. I believe he was released and charges were dropped and immigrated later to Italy after a lot of pressure was exerted by the United States.
Right.
And many Christian fundamentalist groups and a broad range of organizations came out against this guy facing the death penalty for a simple conversion of his religious faith.
Right.
But on the other hand, as you wrote in your article, Selective Outrage, there's really a blind eye turned by the United States and our press and many religious groups against the horrendous subjugation and repression of women on a daily basis in Afghanistan, not to mention the horrendous situation for children and people in general in terms of health. And this is under a U.S. occupation. Say a few words about that, if you would.
Well, yeah, where is the outrage when the same justice system that had Abdul Rahman on trial, where is the outrage when that justice system allows the stoning to death of a woman who is accused of adultery in a remote province of Afghanistan? Where is the outrage when it allows the beating of women by their husbands? When it allows the threatening of journalists for criticizing the warlords or fundamentalists for what they called holy fascism? Where is the outrage about the whole situation, as you said, for the extreme poverty that people still live under in Afghanistan? The U.S. is doing all kinds of elaborate schemes for attacking villages and tracking down terrorists, which they're not very successful at, but they're spending a lot of money on it and have a lot of person power put towards it, but very little has changed in terms of the average standard of living for most people in Afghanistan. Maybe some areas are slightly better off, and of course there's no Taliban there, or the Taliban are less of a force to be reckoned with, although they're coming back. But in terms of getting a job or finding a means of, a shelter, there's no outrage for that.
That was James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission. Contact the group by calling area code 626-676-7884 or visit their website at www.afghanwomensmission.org. In mid-April, gas prices in the U.S. skyrocketed 25 cents in just 2 weeks, bringing the average national price for self-serve regular to $2.91 a gallon, although prices topping $3 a gallon were common. President Bush, already reeling from record low approval ratings, felt the sting of intensifying anger across the nation about rising energy prices, announced his plan to rein in the cost of gas. The president said on April 25th that he'll ask the EPA to temporarily relax clean air regulations, which oil companies claim have caused gas shortages in some northeast states, delay deposits in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, ordered a federal investigation into possible gas gouging, and cut some oil company tax breaks. But consumers, well aware that energy companies like ExxonMobil reported the nation's highest ever profit of $36.1 billion in 2005, are suspicious of the president's cozy relationship with big oil. Republicans who control Congress received 81% of the $54 million in political campaign contributions made by big oil companies since 2001. But election year jitters are causing some GOP congressional legislators to join Democrats in calling for a probe of oil company profits and consideration of a windfall profits tax. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He discusses some reasons behind the dramatic rise in gas prices and explains why he supports a windfall profits tax.
The energy traders in New York have pushed the price of oil above $70. And, you know, because gasoline is manufactured from crude oil, that's a big determining factor in the price of gasoline. But it's not just the Saudi royal family that gets rich when oil prices shoot up to over $70 a barrel. It's any big oil producer. And ExxonMobil and the other big oil companies are huge oil producers. I mean, ExxonMobil alone produces more oil than the entire Kingdom of Kuwait every day. And so combined, all of the big oil companies, including Chevron, Texaco, and ConocoPhillips, and BP, and Shell, they're all producing, you know, as much oil as most of the Middle Eastern nations combined. And so that's a big explanation as to why the oil industry is experiencing record profits. Because on average, it costs a company like ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil and deliver it to the market, whether that extraction is going on in Nigeria or Azerbaijan or Alaska or Texas. So it's costing them $20 a barrel, but they're selling it to the American public at $70 a barrel. To us, that is the classic definition of a windfall profit. They are earning huge amounts of money, not because of any new innovation or efficiency that they've introduced, but simply because the underlying value of the product has skyrocketed in price. And so that's why we are calling for a windfall profits tax on that huge windfall profit and dedicating the revenues from that tax to alternative energy and sustainable and renewable energy and mass transit systems and all sorts of things that will actually go towards solving America's energy crisis.
There's an explanation by the oil companies that goes something like this for the price spike. They say because of environmental regulations, many of the refineries are now reformulating their gas mixture to include ethanol. And therefore, the capacity has shrunk down. Therefore, less supply, the same or more demand, higher prices. What can you tell us about that explanation?
Enron did it during the California energy crisis, and now oil companies are blaming environmental laws for this shoot up in prices. Sure, we've gotten rid of the polluting chemical MTBE, which was a gasoline additive that companies like ExxonMobil were adding to gasoline to make it burn more cleanly. And we've replaced that with ethanol, and there's been some distribution problems. But that alone does not and cannot explain the huge increases in prices at the pump, nor can it explain the huge profits that the industry is making. And it's really important to note that the oil industry often tries to downplay their profits. They say, well, if you compare us to other industries, our level of profit is actually fairly average, which is probably the first time in corporate history that we've ever seen a corporation try to say that they are not a great investment. But when they're talking to Wall Street, they are using a very different measure of profitability. For example, in ExxonMobil's annual report, they say, look, you cannot look at profits as a share of our total sales. You have to look at profits as a share of our capital investment. And when you look at that measurement, ExxonMobil's profit margin globally in 2005 was over 30%. So they had a 30% rate of return on their capital investment. And in their U.S. oil production activities, they had a 46% profit margin. And in the U.S. oil refining, they had a 59% profit margin. So again, that shows to us that this industry is among the most profitable in the U.S. economy, and again gives us the ammunition to support a windfall profits tax on the oil companies.
Tyson Slocum, tell us a little bit about how a windfall profits tax would actually work, and what's the potential support for such a move in the Republican-controlled House and Senate?
For the first time in a very long time, the voices of the people are beginning to be a little louder than the campaign contributions provided by the oil industry. Remember, I mean, the big reason why the oil industry has been immune from scrutiny for so long is that since 2001, they've given $58 million in campaign contributions, with 81% of that going to Republican candidates. But I think for the first time, we're starting to see that even that kind of money that finances reelection campaigns, in, at the end of the day, may not be able to trump the will of the people. And so it's just important for all the listeners out there to write into your senators and representatives and demand that they support a windfall profits tax and that the tax be dedicated to sustainable, clean energy investments and solutions that are going to get America out of this mess.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. In late February, a group of Native people from the Six Nations, or Iroquois Confederacy, began an occupation of land in Caledonia, Ontario, Canada, where a construction company had started building a residential development. The Native people claim the land is theirs, while the company insists it has legal claim to the property. The occupation has attracted Native and non-Native supporters from other parts of Canada and become a focal point of the struggle for Native sovereignty in Canada. In mid-April, police arrested 16 of the occupiers who had blockaded some of Caledonia's streets. According to the local newspaper, up to 500 townspeople rallied on April 24th in opposition to the eight-week occupation. John Cahionis Fadden is a member of the Mohawk tribe, one of the Six Nations. He grew up on the Akwesasne Reservation, which straddles the U.S.-Canadian border between upstate New York, Ontario, and Quebec. Fadden is a historian and director of the Six Nations Indian Museum in northern New York. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Fadden about the history of the land dispute, which he says dates from policies enacted by the British in Canada after the U.S. Revolutionary War. He notes that the Canadian government has now called upon the traditional chiefs and clan mothers in an effort to negotiate a settlement.
Going back to the Revolutionary War, there were some people who within the Iroquois who supported the British, and there were some within the Iroquois who supported the Americans, and there was a great number of them that wished simply to be neutral, and that was the policy of the Iroquois Grand Council at that time, at the beginning. But this war, of course, ranged up and down over their own territories, and they couldn't help but be dragged into it. And as a result of that, those who supported the British after the Revolutionary War ended, their territories were bound to be lost, and therefore they moved further west into this area of southern Ontario beyond Niagara Falls. And this was a huge, I think it was 988,000 acres of land. Those people that are there today are the descendants of those Six Nations people that went there following Joseph Brant after the Revolutionary War. But then through time, some of this good-sized tract of land was eaten up by various events that occurred. And then specific to this land here that is under contention right now, what occurred was that in, I think it's 1841, in the 1800s at any rate, there was this land transaction occurred. The Six Nations people feel that the land was leased to these non-native people. But then the non-native people claim that the land was sold outright, and that therein lies the contention. You know, what's the reason for the problem? Is that these Six Nations people feel that they still own that land. And why they got particularly upset and what created this situation is the fact that there was a company called Henco Limited, I believe, that they built houses, I think with several hundred houses. Meanwhile, the Six Nations people, again, feel that they own that land, and so they went to court in 1990-something. And I really don't know the outcome of that, but I don't, or if there has been one. But it was like an injunction was put against the Indians who had set up their protest camp, and then an injunction was put forth by the Canadian government that they had to leave, and then they just simply refused to leave, and that's where we are today.
John Fadden, what's the latest information you have on the standoff?
Well, I keep getting reports, and some of them are just simply articles from Canada, and some are from Native people, and they don't all agree. But one of them claims that in a nearby city of Hamilton at the airport that there are hangars that have contingents of Canadian armed forces there ready to go. Now, whether that's a fact, I don't know. And that the police, of course, are still around. And I think one number that was used is about 1,000 police officers, including Ontario Provincial Police and RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And see, here's another historic fact, is that in the 1800s, the late 1800s, the Canadian government unilaterally created what's called an elective system. They abrogated the traditional system of the Grand Council of Chiefs and Clan Mothers. And then so they would only deal with the band council that they created. And, of course, you create a band council that you want to work with people that you're able to work with that will be more conducive to going along with what you say and want. And that's what happened just about in every reservation in Canada and in a good number in the United States. You know, they're like colonial governments that were created. But anyway, the traditional form of government based on clan mothers and the chiefs is still existent, and as it is at Akwesasne and other places. But the ones who do most of the administering of various things that need to be administered is done by the band council. But my understanding is that what the band council, they've been dealing with this issue of this land protest, is that they're not able to follow through very well, and so that they've turned it over to the traditional government. And so that the Iroquois Haudenosaunee, or the Six Nations traditional government, is the one speaking with the officials who are there on the other side. And I think that's an interesting thing to have occur, is that they've, you know, gone back to the traditional government that the Canadian government tried to eradicate over a century ago.
That was John Cahionis Fadden, director of the Six Nations Indian Museum in upstate New York. For more information, email Fadden at redmaple@northnet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.